From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Sara Gonzalez from WNYC, in for Maria Hinojosa. This week, stories of escape, from the refugee crisis at the border to its protesters.
You know, we were protesting those places because they, quite honestly, they should have been deported and reunited with their families.
We sort through the distinctions between those protesting the recent influx of immigrants and the more threatening groups. Then, fans of color making themselves known in the fantastic world of comic books.
Well, when I was a child, I was in foster care. I was in the foster system. And that was almost like my escape from reality. I started gravitating towards comic books. And I've just been a nerd ever since.
Also, leaving Cuba for love. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Sara Gonzalez in for Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Sara Gonzalez in for Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking about stories of escape. We begin with the more than 57,000 minors, most from Central America, who escaped their home countries and what their initial experiences are here in the U.S. Being apprehended near a border, ending up at a detention facility, and going before a judge, often alone in immigration court. When the mayor of Murrieta in California told residents that busloads of undocumented immigrants from Central America would be housed at a Border Patrol processing station in their community, dozens of protesters took to the streets to block off roads, causing the three buses to turn around.
Excuse me, folks, you are obstructing the roadway. Please get out of the roadway.
Take them to the border, back to their country.
Since then, there have been reports of protesters around the country showing up in front of churches and colleges, armed with semi-automatic rifles and handguns to oppose migrant children being housed in their neighborhoods. More organized groups are calling for a national protest against what they call a border surge of illegal immigrants. The gatherings are a mix of extremists and other concerned citizens.
Generations of Americans came here by law. They didn't sneak over a border in the middle of the night. You don't want to follow our laws? Go live in Afghanistan!
To help us understand how the tension around the child refugee crisis escalated, Maria Hinojosa spoke with Mark Potok at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He monitors extremism and hate groups around the country.
The protest in Murrieta, California, began with a call from the mayor, Mayor Alan Long, for people to come out and protest the arrival of these children. But it very, very quickly picked up speed. Thanks to a number of different groups. One was a relatively new one, a group called Overpasses for America. It's a group that's described immigrants as freeloaders, cheap labor, and Democrats. The second group involved is ALIPAC, the Americans for Legal Immigration PAC, which is really a one-man operation run by an extremist by the name of William Gein. Gein also invited a very radical group, a group called the Oath Keepers, a militia-type group, to join them. The third principal organizer of these things was a very new group called Make Them Listen, run by a guy named Paul Arnold. Paul Arnold is connected to one of these sort of fake front groups, an allegedly African-American anti-immigration group, which was in fact largely created by some of the larger white anti-immigrant organizations. The Tea Party, one of the Tea Party organizations, has been very active. Fox News, of course, has been really banging the drum on this, as have the very large anti-immigrant or nativist organizations like the Federation for American Immigration Reform and Numbers USA, and even an allegedly nonpartisan immigration think tank, something called the Center for Immigration Studies, one of whose senior fellows said just a few days that Obama, because of his role in the immigration crisis, should be, quote, hung, drawn, and quartered.
Is there an elevated sense of concern on your end?
Yes. I mean, one of our concerns is that we are seeing people very radical groups getting involved. So we, for instance, we have a militia type organization called the Oath Keepers, led by a man named Stuart Rhodes. Stuart Rhodes, among other things, was at the Bundy Ranch standoff in April, in which hundreds of militiamen pointed their weapons directly at federal law enforcement agents and nearly created a bloodbath. And now we have, you know, Fox News beating the drum, people like Gretchen Carlson and especially Todd Starnes. You know, those two in particular attacked in a really, really vicious way a particular group, something called the BCFS Health and Human Services Agency, which is a nonprofit that was setting up to convert an old hotel into a processing facility, a place where some of these children could be held.
Is this a particular moment, what's happening now? Is this one of those historical shifts, or is this just one of the peaks and valleys at this point, a peak in terms of the anger around this issue?
Well, you know, it seems to me a couple things. You know, it's sort of interesting that the militias and those kinds of groups have been so unsuccessful. So I think it's sort of interesting that even though they get, you know, they make a whole lot of noise on Fox TV and you know, the rest of the right wing sort of blogosphere, you know, they're not, it doesn't seem to be doing all that well.
Finally, Mark, is there something that you want people who are in general feeling very discomforted, confused, about this entire scenario, what do you think they need to know to kind of have a sense of context?
Well, first of all, I think that people need to get in touch with the facts. The fact that some U.S. congressman claims that these are disease-carrying gang members, these children who have come to our border, does not make it so. What I would say beyond that is, you know, it is important, I think, to shame some of the liars out there. So that when people go on the public airwaves, when they stand at political podiums and make these claims about immigrants, that there are people, regular American citizens out there who are willing to say no, that is false.
Mark Potok, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
A real pleasure.
That was Maria Hinojosa speaking with Mark Potok, a specialist on hate groups and extremism at the Southern Poverty Law Center. We reached out to the groups Mark says are driving the protests. Ali Pak, the Americans for Legal Immigration group, declined to talk to us, accusing Latino USA of being racially exclusive. They said they won't do interviews with media that, quote, divide Americans among racial lines. Fox News did not respond to our request for a comment, but we did hear from one organization. Maria Hinojosa spoke with James Neighbors, the founder and leader of Overpasses for America. Its members stand on bridges above highways, holding signs that say, secure the border, deport illegals, and impeach Obama.
Did your organization also target sites like church centers and relief facilities where children are being taken to be housed temporarily?
Well, yeah, there were some instances where that happened because, quite simply, our government is participating in human trafficking, and the law that they're using was for what was, you know, basically written for, you know, human trafficking, and, you know, such as you know, the sex trade, and it's being manipulated in order to disperse illegals out across the country. And so, you know, we were protesting those places because they, quite honestly, they should have been deported and reunited with their families. It's cruel to keep them separated from their families.
Do you think that it is problematic, cruel, maybe even, to protest in front of children?
No, I don't think it is, because they're unfortunately being used as pawns by the other side. They're unfortunate victims in this entire situation. They're being used for a political agenda, and it's not against the children that we're protesting. It's against the political agenda that we're protesting.
But still worthy of of witnessing a protest by you?
They need to understand that in America, we have a thing called the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. We, you know, we have the right to do something like that. Political free speech is not always politically correct, and occasionally it does offend some people, and there's not really much you can do about that except tell the truth.
James, do you have a concern about the future of this country becoming increasingly brown?
No, not at all. My own daughter is one quarter, Latino heritage. Her grandfather was originally from Mexico. It's just the rule of law that we want to be, that we want to abide by.
Let's just say that in that process, 20,000 new young immigrants were legally allowed to come as political refugees. That would be okay with you if they did it that way?
Certainly. If they follow the process and they come here legally, I have no problem with that whatsoever.
James Nabors, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
You can find the full, unedited version of Maria Hinojosa's interview with James Nabors on latinousa.org. So James agrees that kids who qualify to stay in the country legally as refugees should be allowed. But the problem is more than half of the 57,000 currently in the country won't have a lawyer. That's according to a study by Syracuse University. So like undocumented adults, children who cross the border alone without their parents aren't guaranteed legal representation. Stacey Jones with the Immigrant Children's Legal Program at the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants connects kids to pro bono lawyers who will represent them in immigration courts across the country.
Sure, thanks for having me.
From the perspective of a child migrant from Central America, what is the process like after they've been apprehended at the border?
That's sort of a flaw, I would say, in the current system is that right now, it's those law enforcement officials from Customs and Border Protection that are the ones doing the screening of the children and trying to find out, is this an unaccompanied child? Why did they come here? These are law enforcement officials. They're not trained in child welfare or people who have been through extreme trauma, which it can be hard for them to open up about some very sensitive topics right off the bat.
Can I get you to sort of paint a picture for me of what this immigration court is like?
So in the room, there'll be a lot of people, sitting in the sort of in the benches, waiting to be called. The judge is up in the front, obviously, with their robe on and facing out to the crowd. At one side will be the ICE attorney, and on the other side would be the child who's there by themselves unless they are there with, a parent or legal guardian or hopefully an attorney.
And so you have 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 8-year-olds making a case for themselves as to why they should be allowed to stay in the country?
Exactly. I mean, if they don't have an attorney, it's up to them to try to even understand this very complicated system.
The risks then being that some of these kids would be deported when they could have potentially qualified for some form of humanitarian relief or protected status in the country.
Exactly. A lot of these kids, they've been through a lot. So, you don't flee to another country on your own as a child over thousands of miles if everything is going perfectly well in your life.
Stacey Jones, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Latino USA, what these kids are escaping from. A teenager and his family from Guatemala leave town after being threatened with death by gang members.
These are children that are coming from different parts of Latin America that are escaping the violence. And for us, it's very important that we treat them with love, because the society is judged on how we treat our children, and that's why we're here.
That's coming up. Stay with us.
Somos pocos, pero estamos locos. Vamos a cambiar este mundo poco a poco. Somos austeros, no somos embusteros. Nos escapamos de la garra de los buitres viejos. Sin complejo ni vino añejo. Solo mensajes antiguos que traspasan el pellejo. Como la brisa que viene del mar.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Sara Gonzalez in for Maria Hinojosa. When you look at the numbers of people, tens of thousands, coming to the U.S. from Central America, the personal stories get buried. Part of what's driving the recent influx of children and families is gang violence. But just to say gang violence doesn't really convey the severity of conditions in Central America. One family from Guatemala says intimidation and threats were constant. They're now asking for refugee status. Reporter Brooke Binkowski went to visit them in San Diego.
Juan is 15 years old. He's from Nuevo Progreso, a small mountain town in Guatemala.
Queríamos ellos que nosotros entráramos a su grupo.
There was a gang that wanted him to join, he says. They recruit young men to sell and smuggle drugs. Juan says he refused because he's a devout Christian and doesn't believe in violence.
Porque ya tantas amenazas y ya nos molestaban mucho seguido cuando.
That's when the gang members started to harass him, punching and kicking him. They threatened to kill Juan, his brother, and the rest of the family. That's when they all decided to leave their town. His parents, three brothers and sister, decided to travel to the United States together. They say they didn't know where else to go, and a relative lives in North Carolina. They ran into bad luck from the start. Their father was beaten by gangs. They were robbed on La Bestia, which is the train that migrants take through Mexico. Their passports were taken. They finally made it to Tijuana and turned themselves into border authorities asking for asylum in the United States. There, they were separated.
Por igual que ella salió primero. Entonces, y como llevabas dos hijos,
that's Silvia, Juan's 20-year-old sister. She didn't know where to find her family because they were processed separately by border authorities. They had no phones or money. So Silvia slept in the street, in front of a 24-hour bail bonds office next to the international border, searching and waiting for them. She waited for 8 days until she found a way to use a phone and found some of her family.
People gave her food. She didn't have any blankets. She just sat in the doorway watching the people coming out of immigration, hoping her family would come out.
That's Lawrence, a San Diego businessman who offered his home to this family. He doesn't want to use his full name because he says the issue is politicized and housing refugees might cost him his job. Lawrence says after watching what happened in nearby Murrieta, when protesters waving American flags forced buses filled with undocumented children to find another city to stay in, he knew he had to do something.
I want my three boys to know that if I die tomorrow, they know they have to do what's right. They know what they have to do is correct, no matter what the popular opinion is, no matter what could happen, and that they have to be able to see these people, as humans. And so it was important for me to humanize them.
San Diego border activist Enrique Morones helped Silvia and Juan find this place to stay. He also found the whole family lawyers and counselors. He says the United States has a moral obligation to help the people fleeing their home countries.
These are children that are coming from different parts of Latin America that are escaping the violence. And for us, it's very important that we treat them with love because the society is judged on how we treat our children, and that's why we're here.
Morona says this is a Rosa Parks moment for the immigration reform movement, and he says the experiences Juan and Silvia's family had embody the entire crisis at the border.
So you have the issue of escaping the violence of Guatemala, getting on top of the train, La Bestia, seeing people pushed off and forced off and all of that, getting the smuggler abandons them in Mexico City, doesn't take them all the way to the border. They have to find their way to the Tijuana border. They turn themselves in to the authorities. The family gets separated.
The family doesn't know what's going to happen next. Juan says all they want is a quiet life.
Paz, tranquilidad y vivir como Dios manda, ¿verdad?
However, their 18-year-old brother was missing for about 2 weeks and now is in a detention center. Their father remains in immigration custody, and they'll all appear before a judge to learn their fate in a few weeks. They still could be considered the lucky ones. After all, they're still alive. For Latino USA, I'm Brooke Binkowski in San Diego.
And now, escaping Cuba. On the island, people know ballet dancers the way they know baseball players and boxers. And in Cuba, the national team is Alicia Alonso's world-renowned ballet company. But increasingly, Cuban dancers are finding a new life in the U.S., leaving for artistic, political, or financial reasons. But as reporter Erica Barris explains, one ballet dancer left for love.
It's early on a sunny summer morning, and Damian Martinez Coro is leading a group of young ballerinas through a rigorous routine. As he moves through the studio, he keeps time while adjusting the girls' forms. The suburban Pittsburgh Dance School is far from Damien's hometown of Matanzas, Cuba. When dancers from the Cuban National Ballet leave or defect, they usually cite economic or creative reasons. They say they want to earn more than $20 a month, or they want to dance different repertoires. But Damien left for a different reason.
But then my girlfriend at that point, she left the country, and then I tried to get over her, but I couldn't, so I found people that helped me to escape the country, and it was an easy decision. It was a very, very tough decision because I loved ballet, I loved the company, and I really thought that I was gonna do great on it. But then I decided to, you know, follow love instead.
Damien and his girlfriend Cynthia Castillo met as teenagers at the prestigious National Ballet School in Havana.
He was like, he and his brother, they were like the popular two guys of the school. Like, they had girlfriends weekly, a different one. And I was like a little popular too. And when we started, like, everybody was like, oh my gosh, they won't last a week.
They lasted longer than a week. But then, at age 18, Cynthia got a visa and moved to Miami, leaving a lovelorn Damien behind.
I met these guys from her neighborhood that were thinking about building a boat. And I asked them if I could, you know, jump in.
I sent the money for him, my only $400, the only ones I had in my bank.
The boat was built in secret. It was made of wood, irrigation pipes, and a car engine. The trip isn't safe on homemade boats. People die on the journey. But if they make it, Cubans are given asylum in the United States. If they don't, there are repercussions for those who attempt to leave the communist country and fail. As soon as Damien and his friends took to the water, they realized there was a leak in the boat, and the ocean was rough.
Because I thought every wave was going to be the last wave we'll see. It was really bad. At some point, I was like, please, somebody come and get us. I didn't care if it was the Coast Guard. I didn't care who was, but somebody come and get us.
And at that point, I'm like, oh my gosh, why did I do this? But then Damien came and everything changed. Like, that was the greatest thing that happened ever for me.
The group landed on an uninhabited key off of South Florida. Several days later, they were rescued.
So that day redefined hope for me. Like, once you think everything is messed up and you can go no more and that's going to be the last wave, well, chances are you're going to have another wave and another one until you make it all the way to the end. And that's what we did. It really redefined everything I knew about hope.
Once the couple was together, they faced different obstacles. They needed to work. Cynthia and Damien had been trained at the elite National Ballet School in Cuba. They expected to easily land dancing jobs.
I thought it was going to be the big job. I mean, for God's sakes, I thought it was so good. And then, like, I thought everybody was going to, like, beg me to dance with them.
Like, you think you're going to come here, be principal dancer in Houston, Boston, everywhere. And it's not that simple or easy.
They got jobs at a supermarket. Damien as a butcher, Cynthia in the bakery, and they took English classes at night. Eventually, they landed with a small company in South Carolina and then with the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater, where they danced for a season. Now, they both occasionally perform and regularly teach at studios. For the most part, dancers who leave Cuba find work. Last year, a group defected while on tour in Mexico. Within 6 months, they'd all landed with companies. There are Cubans in the top-tier companies, such as the Boston Ballet and the American Ballet Theater, and they're in the smaller ones too, six in the Cincinnati Ballet, for example. Judy Ray Tubbs is a resident choreographer at Laurel Ballet Theater in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. She's worked with Cynthia and Damien, whom she adores, and says the technique and dedication of Cuban dancers is exceptional. In insular Cuba, though, they're rarely exposed to outside dance or modern ballet.
It's kind of one of those catch-22 things for Cuba. I think that they teach these young people to be ambitious, to be self-disciplined, to be hardworking, and then they have them in an environment where that ambition can't be fully realized, where that hard work can't really pay off. So then they go searching for another environment where all those things they were taught through this regimen can be fulfilled, and it's not Cuba. Unfortunately for Cuba, it's not Cuba.
Just last year, Damien helped his twin brother, David, move to Orlando. Because Damien is now a citizen, he was able to use the family reunification policy. David had been with the Cuban National Ballet for 8 years. Damien said he initially tried to talk his brother out of moving to the U.S.
Me and I said, like, David, I have a very good life. I'm very happy. I love this country. But you have a living that you don't appreciate in Cuba if you're thinking that you're going to have a better one here. What is a better life? A car? A house? I mean, what's a better life? You're doing what you like in Cuba. You're with your wife. You have a house. You're with your son. How is that any better than, I mean, how can you ask for better?
Damien and Cynthia have settled into their lives in Pittsburgh. They still struggle with some things. Damien still instinctively wants to kiss people on the cheek when he first meets them. The winters are cold, and they miss things they never thought they'd miss, like having ration books and the camaraderie at the store when food arrived.
The oil, the cooking oil came in. Oh, because the fries came in. Hey, the fries
That's
came
so
in. And
funny. Like, I remember
there's
that.
There's one bodega recall.
Oh,
so
the
like,
chicken in the meat department.
In the palm in la bodega.
No, la carnicería.
Oh, yeah, la carnicería. I mean, I don't know. So like, you would go to like, pescado, pescado.
Now in their late 20s, they're getting old for dancers. In Cuba, there isn't much opportunity once a dancer's career is over. But for them here, there is. The couple is opening their own dance studio.
Yeah, the other day I was like staring at the building. They're taking a moment down and said, like, my goodness, this is our place. This is only in America, only in US, that, you know.
That's true, yeah.
This is the country of opportunities, you know. That's good that the American dream is still alive, you know, for like two guys that are coming from Cuba.
They still keep up with their old classmates and teachers. Nearly all of them are working in Europe, Latin America, or across the U.S., forming a diaspora of Cuban dancers around the world. For Latino USA, I'm Erica Barris in Pittsburgh.
Our next story takes place in Georgia with an alternative to traditional higher ed. It's woven into the American dream. If you go to college, you can get a good job. But what if it costs too much and financial aid isn't available? That's the case for many undocumented students in this country. About half the states don't allow undocumented students to receive in-state tuition rates, which are cheaper. And three states ban them from even being admitted at some public universities. But in Georgia, some students have found a workaround. They've created what they call Freedom University. Reporter Ellie Yu has our story.
Jack up the sound, see if you recognize this song.
Volunteer professor Bethany Morton starts off the day's lecture with some music. It's Sunday afternoon, and about 30 students are gathered inside a room at the Martin Luther King Center in downtown Atlanta. Some students say they hear the song at church, but this class is about immigrant labor movements, and that's where this song, De Colores, fits in.
It was kind of the official theme song of United Farm Workers Association.
Morton is a professor of history and women's studies at the University of Georgia, but the syllabus she creates for Freedom University is different. It's focused on teaching history that's relevant, she says, and it's also more than just a class.
I think for a lot of the students, a huge part of the experience has just been being in a room where everyone but the professors is undocumented. It's been a supportive environment for them with the kinds of challenges that they face in Georgia.
Specifically, there are two policies the Georgia Board of Regents passed in 2010. One banned undocumented students from attending the top five universities in the state, and the other denied them in-state tuition at the schools they could attend. Supporters of the policy say that undocumented students shouldn't get preference over those who are, quote, lawfully present, and a Board of Regents spokesman says these policies fully comply with laws of the state. So Morton and three other University of Georgia professors professors decided to create a school that would give these students another opportunity. They named it after the Freedom Schools, created for African Americans in the South during the Civil Rights Movement.
History comes knocking on your door, and you either respond or you don't.
22-year-old Gustavo was one of Freedom University's very first students in 2011. He came to the U.S. with his family when he was 9, and when he graduated high school in 2009, realized he couldn't afford to go to college. Instead, he worked at a gas station.
Pretty depressing. And, you know, it was very much like just really taking it day by day because I didn't know how I was going to get to college. I didn't know when I was going to be able to go to college.
With the help of Freedom University and a scholarship fund, Gustavo was accepted at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, where he's now a junior. He said the idea of college had faded until one professor urged him to apply.
Another reason why I really like Freedom University is because it kind of goes against that sort of like individualistic culture that is, you know, that like permeates American colleges, where, you know, it's really kind of a cutthroat environment. But here, you know, we're working together because we're struggling together.
This past summer, Gustavo has come back to intern with Freedom University and help other students.
So I was actually told to talk about my college experience. But before that, I want to talk about, like...
I'm not telling you anything.
Freedom University has helped several young men and women go to college out of state. They do not get course credit here, but they get SAT prep and professors write them letters of recommendations and help with applications. Since it started, about 180 students have come through Freedom University, and about a dozen have gotten full scholarships to private universities outside of Georgia, including Berea, Dartmouth, and Syracuse. This fall, 24-year-old Jonathan Zuniga Hernandez will enter Tougaloo College in Mississippi, all expenses paid.
I honestly can't say that. I can't be any more happier right now.
Zuniga Hernandez graduated back in 2008 and was accepted to Georgia Tech to study computer science. But after finding out there was no aid for undocumented students, he left his family to attend college in Mexico. He came back late last year after finding out his sister got a full scholarship to a college through Freedom University.
It's definitely the opportunity that I was always seeking for, even though it's been 5 years. Like, I don't mind that. Like, I don't see myself not performing. I don't see myself not taking advantage of this opportunity.
And this summer, he even went to the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer in Mississippi with other undocumented students. In this room at the King Center, murals of civil rights leaders line the walls. Last semester, veterans of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee spoke to students about organizing. And 21-year-old Freddie Mosso, who is a Freedom University alum and now at Syracuse, says they'll continue to organize to oppose policies that prevent undocumented students from getting an education.
We need a Freedom U because there's nothing there out there for us. But when we get in a situation, when we get the ban lifted, we get financial aid, we get equal access to education, there won't be a need for Freedom University. You know, that's the ultimate goal. So it's kind of, we're trying not to exist anymore by making these policies, you know, reverse. You know?
Until then, the doors are open at Freedom University. For Latino USA, I'm Ellie Yu in Atlanta, Georgia.
Coming up on Latino USA, the world of comic books and a conversation about diversity.
It's intense to see all these races now. It's not just a white man's sport anymore.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Cerca de la piscina,
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Sara Gonzalez in for Maria Hinojosa. Sometimes the best way to escape is through an improbable story of action and adventure. So today, producer Daisy Rosario brings us the second in her four-part series on diversity in geekdom. Face front, true believers. Today we talk comics.
Oh, man. What else did you get? I got this.
So it's your first convention,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
how's it feel?
I feel like a little kid again.
Again, right?
This is my rebirth.
In the halls of the Javits Convention Center in New York City, two guys are nerding out.
And the spot with the lids! Oh, you don't want these? Oh, you want me to keep these?
Friends Angel Vega and Juan de los Santos are showing each other their stuff. We're at Special Edition New York City, a comic book convention, and they've been shopping for comics, superhero art, and action figures all day. So I had to ask Angel, who's your favorite superhero?
Spider-Man. I mean, New York City. I'm from New York, so he's my friendly neighborhood hero.
Angel has loved comics for years, but this is his first convention. Juan is more seasoned and is egging Angel on about his purchases. It's clear they've talked about what this day will be like for a while. Like many, Juan got into it as a kid.
Well, when I was a child, I was in foster care. I was in the foster system. And that was almost like my escape from reality. I started gravitating towards comic books. And I've just been a nerd ever since.
The idea of a savior really spoke to him.
When you found yourself just up against the wall, when you were boned, essentially, there would always be that magic man in a blue suit from the heavens that came to rescue you from that. And then Batman, for example, went through... I can relate to his story, and except I'm not fighting crime, and I'm not strong. But I get that. I get why he became who he became.
Even though Juan can relate to some heroes, it still surprises him that a well-known character would look like him. In 2011, Marvel created an alternate version of Spider-Man, who is Afro-Latino. Instead of Peter Parker, Ultimate Spider-Man is the story of Miles Morales, the Brooklyn-born son of an African-American dad and a Latina mom. But even Juan didn't have very high hopes.
I thought it wasn't going to move as much because he's black and Spanish. That ain't going to move. But I'm glad that people embraced him, that fans embraced Miles as what for a superhero, for what he is, you know? Everything is just so well written. You're following him on his journey as he's learning. You're learning with him. It's refreshing.
And lifelong self-described nerds like Juan get to witness it.
It's intense to see all these races now. It's not just a white man sport anymore.
Juan and Angel aren't outliers. The convention crowd is hugely diverse, in every way. Not only are Latinos and other people of color everywhere, but various LGBTQ couples walk hand in hand, all ages are represented, and a few people with disabilities are pulling off some impressive costumes. Yet the comic books themselves still seem marketed mostly to straight white men. But thanks to the internet, non-white fans are making themselves known in a way they couldn't before. Meanwhile, over in another hall, the longest line I've seen all day is for...
Very excited to be moderating this panel, reimagining a female superhero.
The room is packed.
My name is Ben Saunders. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon. I was hired to teach Shakespeare and early modern poetry. I got tenure, and I've been teaching comics ever since.
Fans like Cristela Rosa ask questions.
I asked if they had any opinions regarding just the general representation of not just women in general, but also women of color.
Cristela is Filipina, from Long Island.
So, like, growing up with comics, like, I love comics, but I saw so little of myself. I was always liking more of the male characters, too, for that reason. And then I remember, I kept getting back on and off again with the wagon reading comics, and the first time I ever saw the second Batgirl... And her whole entire face is covered. I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be great if that character were, like, actually Asian underneath? And her cowl comes off. I'm like, oh, my God.
She was Asian.
This is the first thing for me. And it's
one Batgirl, Cassandra Cain, was a character of Asian descent. But Cristela wants more.
I am actually creating my own characters. Their stories are a little loose, but I am, like, creating who they are. Which is part of the reason why I really want to participate in this.
Cristela is waiting for a panel on getting into the industry. Because even as the internet has made it more clear that the fans are diverse, character-wise, comics are still...
dominated by white male protagonists.
This is David Marquez. He's an artist. In fact, he draws Miles Morales, the Afro-Latino Spider-Man.
As I've become more active in the industry and coming to shows and everything, it's very clear that doesn't reflect the reality of fandom, that doesn't reflect the reality of, you know, the creators. It's a much more diverse culture than perhaps some people would expect.
I know what it is, but he said it's really good, and it's all in the story.
You know, coming to shows, I couldn't say how many times I've seen young African-American or Latino readers come up and say, you know, this is a Spider-Man that looks like me, I identify with.
Which has affected his choices.
I've definitely passed up other opportunities to work on other books, and maybe other books that sell more than the Miles Morales series does. But it's specifically the experience of working on the book and, you know, meeting the fans and seeing the impact that the character makes that's made me want to stay on the book. It's something that, it's a feeling that I'm doing something important, doing something that's good.
This is where the internet is invaluable to diversity. It brings this awareness out of the convention halls and takes it everywhere.
Suddenly, the message and control of the message and control of visibility has become much, much more democratic.
Rachel Edidin has worked as a comic book editor. She's also a writer, podcaster, and pop culture journalist.
The biggest shift has been Twitter and Tumblr, public social media. People can speak up and they can organize in ways that aren't geographically oriented and form significant vocal blocks and really stand up and be counted in a way that they weren't before. And it's also a lot easier for them to find and talk directly to creators and to publishers, and a lot easier for creators to reach fans.
And while the social media aspect is new, Rachel insists that the fandom is not.
You know, the idea that we're other, that women, that people of color, that queers aren't part of comics, aren't real in the same way that those dudes in the target demographic are, infuriates me. Because we've been making comics for as long as anybody else. We've been reading comics for as long as anybody else. We're not playing in someone else's sandbox. We are professionals, we are editors, we are writers, we are cartoonists. No one means to have all
that power. In other words, they are comics. For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
To hear an extended version of Daisy's piece with more interviews and links, visit our website, latinousa.org. Now, a little housekeeping. AC Valdez is our senior producer.
Hi, Sara. Before Maria took off for a much-deserved vacation, we sat down and talked a little about the response we got to our recent episode, Blue, which dealt with suicide, depression, alcoholism, a lot of heavy stuff. Thanks for sitting down with me about this, Maria.
I'm really interested to hear what the response was to these, to our stories, yeah.
Especially when you're talking about a story like mental health or alcoholism, which is hard to do when you, and put your face to it. So we got a lot of email, a lot of social media.
Uh-huh. And one of the emails that we got was from Vincent. He says, thank you so much for a wonderful story on alcoholism. I say wonderful because alcohol is glorified in our society, but has devastating effects on our families. Thank you again for keeping it real and telling our stories good and bad.
And we love that, right? Because part of what we want to do is to tell, you know, the celebratory stories about Latinos. But the truth is that Latinos die of alcoholism at some rates that are pretty unknown. So thank you so much, Vincent, for that.
And Mary writes, hello, I'm a new listener from Europe. My husband turned on the live NPR feed and listened to two very important issues, depression and alcoholism in the Hispanic community. Right away, I am asking myself if there are anywhere near enough Spanish-speaking psychotherapists or drug counselors in the U.S. I grew up in Mississippi, where the need for help outside the family was viewed as weakness. Is this also a block for the Latino community? Thank you for your response.
Right, Mary Richards. And unfortunately, like you said, and your experience of growing up in Mississippi when going to help outside of your family was a weakness, there is still a lot of that. I think part of what we're saying with these stories is to say, if you need help, there's help out there.
Right. And to get to Mary's point, actually, about whether there are enough Latino health professionals, I actually went to the NIH website and looked it up. There are 29 Latino mental health professionals for every 100,000 Latinos in this country. That as compared to 173 white mental health professionals for every 100,000 whites in this country.
Wow. That's a great number, AC. Thanks for that.
Rosanna and another writer, Anita, brought up more or less the same concern. Our interviewee, Dina, expressed a lot of reservations about taking the medication she had taken because she had such a severe reaction to it. Anita writes, "As a Latina psychiatric provider, I found your program today on mental illness reprehensible. By describing lamotrigine as such a dangerous drug, you will have indirectly caused suicides, hospitalizations, and imprisonment. You devoted, wasted, most of your program's time describing how the patient had Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which is very rare. Because of lamotrigine, my patients have been able to go back to school, start new careers, stay out of jail, become good parents, retain their jobs, stay out of the mental hospital, and stay off the streets."
I really appreciate the notes that Rosanna and Anita are raising. I don't think our intention was to create fear around taking meds for mental illness, but rather to say, if you are going to take meds, be very aware of the meds that you are taking and be really clear about the fact that there are very clear side effects. And they're not just words that you hear on a screen. They actually can impact your lives. Those are strong words, Anita. On the other hand, I think that they're strong words because she takes this really, really seriously as a Latina psychiatric provider. So what our piece did, AC, I think, was to increase the dialogue. That's what we wanted. You know, AC, when you get a lot of love from your listeners and then you get a lot of criticism, it's hard to take. But at the same time, this is all about talking. And one of the issues that we covered on our show is that for many Latinos and for people in general, talking about mental health, talking about mental illness, talking about alcoholism, suicide, it's not stuff you want to talk about, but we have to. So I appreciate everybody who took time to share your thoughts. Whether you were criticizing us or applauding us, we're having a conversation, and that's a great first step.
Right, and I would encourage everybody listening to this to contact us either via our website, latinousa.org, and you can click on contact at the top of the page, or you can find us on Facebook or tweet us at LatinoUSA.
And I just want to say thanks again to Jay and Dina for sharing their story and for all of our listeners for taking the time to write to us.
We've been talking about the many different forms of escape. For today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom, we hear from Panamanian Americans who escaped a cycle of crime and violence. From the Oakland hip-hop group Los Racas, here's Raca Dune.
My name is Abdul Dominguez Green, a.k.a. Raca Dune, a.k.a. Dun Dun, from the California and Panama group named Los Racas. Todos van a die. Si me toca seguro tu mamá gonna cry. Porque tú eres reina. Hablan pura vaina. Diez que roban y hacen pura maldad. No. I grew up in Panama City, man. Real, real humble. It was like seven of us, all my brothers and sisters, living in one room. So my image of United States, it was like every kid that has their own room. Big living room, big kitchen separate from everything. You know what I mean? Everything wasn't right there like in Panama. So I graduated from middle school and my auntie took me to Virginia as a present. I was just supposed to come for vacation. And then my other auntie in California, she called me. She was like, "You want to stay with me and go to school over here, learn English and help your family?" I was like, yes, you know, because I thought that was going to be a simple mission. And that's when I moved to Oakland. Perdóname, mama. Pronto yo vi rico, vamos a estar en la fama con lana. In a place like Oakland, you know, it's already limited over there for youth. So imagine a youth without papers. Like, I would try to get jobs at, like, Foot Locker, you know what I mean, McDonald's, stuff like that. But I couldn't because I didn't have that social security number. One time, I used the fake one, and they knew it was fake. What was hard was missing my family, you know what I mean, and not being able to go back. Back then, I didn't really used to talk about my problems, so they figured out a way, like, okay, just write them down. So I started writing what I thought, but with rhyming. And that's really when I started making music right there. Oh, yeah, then up on the bus. Que días a ver si deseas parquear. La guía sonrió, dice, ese era mi plan. Bueno, vine con mi pan. No let your friends stand. Que no bueno, I had my mom calling me, telling me that she needed help with my sister's school and stuff like that. And I feel like helpless. Like, the reason why I'm here in the United States was to help my family. And they calling me and they need help and I can't even help them. I did those jobs a couple of times where you stand on the corner
And whichever car come through, and he's like, I need two of ya, I need three of ya. I didn't really feel like doing that. It was like, I'm not gonna do this. You know, I got way too much talent for this, you know, more prideful, you know what I mean? Some of those dudes, they got families and stuff, so it don't matter how prideful you are, you gotta do those jobs. Ya no soy el mismo joven inocente. America me convirtió en delincuente. The youth is sometimes gonna go the easy route, you know what I mean, which is selling drugs or robbing people and stuff. I didn't do none of that stuff in high school. When I got out of high school, where the real world started, where you gotta start making money for your rent. So, you know, that's what I started doing, because I got frustrated and I just started robbing people. And that's something we don't really talk about. But now that these songs come out, you know, I like touching on it just so people to see, like, these songs come from real emotions, you know what I mean? Like, I just wanted to show what can happen to the youth if you decide to make a mistake like that, you know what I mean, or to do something negative. A lot of people still think coming over here is easy and everything's gonna be good. Like, nah, it's not gonna be, especially if you of color, especially if you're an immigrant. I feel like the system over here, like, is meant for you to fail. It's up to you. You can fit into that, or you can figure out ways of making it here without having to go through the street life. I'll be telling my homies that got talent, God gave us an option, you know what I mean? Please don't fall into that. We got talent. It's gonna be hard, but it's a way out, you know what I mean? It's a way out. Estos manes no conocen nada de mí, ni saben lo que he tenido que hacer para vivir. La vida en América no es como creí, ni menos como piensan los que no viven aquí. Es dura.
After spending 12 years away from his family, Rakadun got his papers and was able to visit Panama last year. He was smiling the whole time, he says. The major label debut from Los Racas is out now. It's called El Negrito Dundun y Ricardo. To hear more of their music, check out our website, latinousa.org. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Katie Davis, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, Sara Rocha, and Roxanne Scott. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to the folks at KOPB, as well as Jacqueline Sincotta, Jim Schachter, and Nancy Solomon at WNYC. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Sara Gonzalez from WNYC, in for host and executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I love fighting dinosaurs with my fists.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.